Oh, hey, how are you?
Great to hear.
Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable.
Like a drink?
Sure.
There you go.
Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin?
Now, occasionally, I get out of the Tech Lounge and go and speak to people at events and conferences. And today I am going to feature two older interviews. Any of you who have been listening to the show for a little while and will remember the old name, the old format, they might have been recorded. Then there's going to be obviously a period of transition. And these are two interviews from KubeCon earlier in the year. One is with Leonard, who is a part of the CNCF Sustainability Working Group. We had a really interesting conversation about sustainability and cloud native. And the second is with Didi from Codium AI. That was recorded on the floor at KubeCon. So not quite as quiet and intimate, but I hope you enjoy the interviews. Before we begin, there's just a few people at the door who've got some things they want to tell you. Then we can get stuck in. If you'd rather not hear these interruptions, then please support the show. You can find details in the episode and show notes. Leonard, we missed each other at KubeCon, and you are the chair. I've spoken to a few people from this tag, but you are the chair of the environmental sustainability tag at CNCF. Now, we should probably, I did cover this when I spoke with others, but we should probably quickly unpack what a tag is before we go any further.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, that's I think like very important piece of the puzzle to understand kind of our contributions. Actually, there are like two other chairs as well. So we have three people. So a tag stands for a technical advisory group. So it's an extension of the technical oversight committee. So that the CNCF and the Linux Foundation, to manage all these projects, they have like quite a bit of like different groups and teams and domains. So it's if you're like starting sort of to try to understand like how it all works together, it's kind of complicated at first. But in the CNCF, it basically, so we have like the governing board, which manages like the money and the funds and things like this. We have the technical oversight committee, which manages, okay, what are the projects in the foundation and which projects move levels. And because then there's also CNCF staff and recently a technical advisory board, which is just like end users, giving them like a little bit more influence, adopters, end users, especially when it comes to like to reference architectures and things like this. And because the landscape in the CNCF grew a lot, so we started out, I think like six projects or something. Now we have like, I don't know, I need to check, like over 170 projects, maybe 180 even. So because of this, it's obviously getting a little bit more challenging to navigate the space. And a couple of years ago, we started having these extensions called technical advisory groups, which are responsible for certain domains. So you also have like a tag security or tag storage, tag network, runtime, and so on. And we are the youngest tag, 2 years old, about environmental sustainability. And yes.
Okay. So I've covered this a little bit in the past. I spoke with, I think, Max at the Open Summit last year. I believe he's, I hope I haven't made a mistake there. He's also in the tag, yeah?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
He's also in the tag, yeah.
You have a lot of sort of practical talks around the subject, which is something I am quite a fan of myself. And you have you have a whole bunch of things from March the 20th, but which I guess were all sort of related to KubeCon. But you have two topics in particular that I was interested in speaking to you more about. And one is the kind of the overall thing. So you have like a landscape of energy management tools for cloud projects. I guess without going into it, just a lengthy reeling off of all the options, what is the kind of the general ways that people can measure
cloud impact at the moment.
Right. So at the end, so when you think about sustainability, it is like a whole bunch of things, right? It's not just energy or CPU or things like this, right? It's like a whole lot of things. And the tech just focuses on the environmental side of things when it comes to resources. So we are not too concerned about like social aspects, which are very important, but we are focusing on the technical aspects of the environmental aspects. So basically, if you have like this giant diagram of topics which are in sustainability, we kind of narrow it down quite a bit.
Yeah.
And if we want to like make like the first steps into this field, we focus a lot on energy.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, maybe also on resources, and maybe at some point also natural resources are also interesting to us. But for now, it's about energy. And so if you want to make like any decisions, you need to have like some sort of metric, right?
Yeah.
You need to have like some kind of idea what you're making decisions about. So that's why like a lot of efforts are around observability and getting like an idea of, okay, what is our energy footprint, and in extension, what are the emissions caused by consuming this energy? So if you start looking into energy in the cloud, so there's so we have like a lot of resources, right? We have like distributed systems, a lot of machines, and at the end, you can like accumulate from all those machines the processes and kind of map it to the energy consumption. So you have APIs on a lower level basis.
Yep.
So it's good to have bare metal access, because then you can have access to those APIs that give you information, like REPL, for example, from Intel.
Yep.
Or like there's like, depending like on your hardware, there are APIs which you can use.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can accumulate all of this, map it to processes. So you have not just like the total per machine, but actually have like a little bit more, like a better understanding, okay, this process consumes X amount of energy.
Yep.
And at the end, this is then converted to emissions.
Yeah.
But in the cloud, there's also more things, right? Because we not just have like accumulation of all those machines, but we also have like scalability things, like scheduling wise and so on, right? And I think in terms of understanding like how our scheduling and scaling impacts environmental sustainability metrics, we are not, I think this is like a subject which we need to work on. It's not something that we have the best metrics right now in terms of like understanding, okay, this machine, this process consumes X amount of energy. We have quite good information, quite good resources. So you can use Scafandra, for example, or Kepler. I think that both of those tools are very great. Can be used, but to, and this is like also what my talk was about at KubeCon. So telling like a story about your cluster and understanding, okay, I don't know, I have like a pod which breaks or things like this and needs to restart. Maybe it's not that expensive, but maybe, I don't know, restarting takes some time. So understanding sort of, okay, maybe I should fix it at some point because I'm wasting every hour or so restarts or things like this. And this can be translated into like underutilization, and can be translated into waste of energy. Or like, they're like a bunch of like Kubernetes capabilities, which we do not map to resources, which can help, I think, understanding our cluster setup.
Okay, so many talking points from that. So I think the first thing I just wanted to, so I say traditionally, but I don't know if there's really such a thing in this field, but a lot of people were using some of the like the cloud providers' cost APIs. So is that something that in the recent time has sort of been deprecated? We don't really need to do that anymore? That there's better options available now, or are people also still using some of those?
So so there's like a, for sure, like a correlation between like performance and energy consumption, and also like a correlation between cost and energy.
Yeah.
But a correlation is not always like a, it does not give you like the real numbers, right? It just gives you like a hint. If you improve your cost, it should for the most part also improve your CO2 consumption, right? But so I have like one problem with this. I have like a problem with like looking at cost too much, because you want to. I think it's like a very good step. So if you're like concerned about like in your footprint and so on, I think it's like a very good step which you can take right now.
Yeah,
and we have like good tools you can use. It's like an established field. There are like a lot of like talks, blog posts, books.
Yep.
You can actually do something about it, and I think it's good to care about those things. But if you look at like improving this field for a long term, we need to have like access to those metrics at some point. We need to have like information about the resource consumption that we use, because I think there's just like one argument which I think is kind of very easy. So we are looking at cost and performance forever.
Mm.
But we are in a problem, like in a position where energy consumption and resource consumption of software is a problem, because we are getting out of touch.
Yeah.
So just in the future, looking at cost and performance will not solve this, right? Because we are looking at those metrics forever.
Yeah,
so
okay.
I think we need to have other metrics as well.
So it abstracts the problem too much.
Exactly. The only reason, and I'm saying this all, like every day, not every day, but like in every conversation, sort of the only reason why we have hardware is that we run software, and hardware people cannot make the decision how to utilize their hardware. Software is utilizing hardware. So we need to be in touch with hardware sort of at some capacity to really move this forward.
I like this approach, and this will lead very much to the talk you had at KubeCon, but I want to ask one more software question, because you mentioned things like the observability data and stuff like that. From some of my own experiments, a lot of impact comes from some of those ancillary services like databases and even transmission and things like that. How many of the tools you've looked at recently will also allow you to monitor those? Or is it a case of also, if you have access, installing them on those ancillary services? You know, with cloud providers, you may not actually have the option, but are there better options available for also measuring those or not yet?
So I have just looked at this like on a more like holistic level.
Okay.
So like it's specific technologies, how they relate to energy consumption. I think it's like very interesting like case study, which we should do maybe at some point.
Yeah.
And in the tag, environmental sustainability, we are actually like on the way to having more transparency about certain CNCF projects, how they perform and how you can observe them.
Yeah.
So we have a working group called Green Reviews.
Yeah.
So we built, it's like a technical project. At the end, we built a platform where we pull from release to release, like the binaries from CNCF projects. And then we do like a bunch of benchmarking and publishing metrics, and just see like how they perform at those metrics from release to release. But I think for the most part, if you have like access to the low level metrics, and then you, at the end, like these like databases and so on, they are also like processes, right? So you can observe them similar. There's nothing too special about this. Maybe if you look at like, of course, like IO and like storage utilization, this needs to be like captured. But most hardware like APIs capture have like a good overview. There's like not a lot of things that you don't miss out. Mm. Like one thing which you always need to keep in mind is these APIs are software based approximations.
Yeah.
So there's like a little bit of like correlation happening.
Yeah.
But these are quite good for the most part. So if you use like these low level APIs and you don't have like a hardware meter, you don't have like a thing between your PSU and the power outlet. These gives you like the exact numbers.
Yeah.
The software metrics are correlations, or like they have like a small error margin. But for the most part, this is like negligible, right?
This was interesting. This wasn't a talk at KubeCon. This was actually a talk from FOSDEM earlier in the year from one of the engineers on the Firefox profiler. Firstly, because he actually went into detail about how they got all those CPU process metrics and how each platform had its own advantages and disadvantages, and they weren't really the ones you were expecting from each platform. But also he did a lot of demos of him using power meters.
I mean, like when it comes to GPUs, I was reading a paper which came out this month in March this year, And there was like sometimes an error margin of NVIDIA GPUs of 5%, so which is, I think, a lot. But
yeah, that's quite
for
high.
For Intel chips or like AMD and things like this, that these numbers are, from what I've seen, pretty accurate. So
yeah. Okay, so your talk at KubeCon actually something I think I wrote down after an event last year, where I wrote down what was the impact of using, how useful would eBPF be for these metrics? And that's exactly what your talk was about. So eBPF. This is something I've covered on the show before. But maybe very, very, very quickly, let's just explain what E in brackets BPF is, and then what got you to thinking around its function in terms of energy consumption.
Right. So I'm like a disclaimer. I'm not like an eBPF expert.
Oh no! Don't worry. I think there's a handful of
people in the community who are like really experts. What I was interested. This was actually for me like an afterthought, because I was just looking at, okay, we have like an observability, not like a problem, but like a challenge, so to say, right? We need to solve this. We need a lot more metrics.
Yep.
And I thought like there's like a bunch of talks about eBPF. eBPF needs or should be of some help. So I was just curious and finding out how this could maybe help us out.
Yeah.
And moving past these challenges. So what I've learned in the last months looking at eBPF from time to time was it does not help us with getting the energy metrics. It helps us understanding the energy metrics.
Okay.
So we have these APIs, REPL and so on, which I talked about, which we should use also in the future. But those metrics do not tell us, does not give us like a good understanding like how this the processes, how does the process affect the energy consumption, right? So because the energy consumption is like a total, you cannot break it down even, right? So you can use eBPF because eBPF gives you utilization and it gives you, okay, like processes are starting and so on. You receive packages. You can dip into all those metrics and then map it to at the end, you have like a better overview how your machine is getting utilized and how basically all this utilization comes together, and then you can break it down into energy consumption. So especially also when it comes to network, I think this is like for us right now like a big part which we do not observe. It's like I think one of the that you cause a lot of traffic. That you use all this infrastructure.
Yeah.
I think that's something that we need to take a look at. And networking and observability of networking is something that we do with eBPF for some time.
Yeah.
So having this information and then just mapping it back to the energy consumption and to also finding out how many stops do you have in the internet to reach your destination, so to say. And all of things. So eBPF does not help us to get the information about energy consumption, but it helps us, or it can help us, to make sort of sense of it and tell a story.
Yeah.
And the Kepler project already uses eBPF. They use eBPF to break down exactly what I just mentioned. That they're breaking the total footprint energy consumption down into pods and processes.
Okay.
They could go like a step further, like in terms of networking and telling like a story, sort of about the deployment. And so I think we are already on the way. We are already utilizing eBPF in this space.
Are you aware of any efforts in that community to look into that, or
in the Kepler project? Or
no, I guess Kepler is more focused on the environmental side of things. eBPF is more broad. So I guess probably more on the eBPF side.
I think not directly. I think there's like a bunch of like use cases which you can power by eBPF. So if they implement, like if they add support for certain, I don't know, like events and things like this, then it triggers like a whole bunch of use cases which can then be implemented. So I've talked to them and they are like aware of the space and they're also interested, but it's not like its own thing, right? You have like, when you visit the eBPF website, you have like these four pillars.
Yeah.
What was it? Yeah. Like security, networking, and like two other things. And I don't see that like soon there will be also sustainability because it's like a meta metric, right? Because you don't gather like CO2. It's like something that you, it's like based on a lot of like approximations and it's an
assumption.
Right. It's like,
And that is also, that kind of comes back to that talk from the Firefox people of like, the processor has to also support that as well.
Right.
And on servers, probably more likely than not, but there's also, you know, all these layers of abstraction sometimes as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Very few people are really actually doing bare metal anymore.
I mean, that's good, right? That's good.
I don't know. Hard to say, isn't it?
I mean, if we need to do like everything all over again with every project, that would be terrible, right? If we cannot use any libraries and... If we need to, I don't know.
Oh, there's plenty of people who enjoy this, but that's...
I mean, definitely. Yeah.
So what took you to this path? Because as far as I can tell, you are still...
I'm still a student.
Yeah. Still a student? Yeah. So what are you studying and what took you down this path, I suppose?
I'm studying computer science. And
okay, makes sense.
I'm writing my thesis actually now, my master thesis.
Okay.
My journey, I started working in the cloud field. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, like third semester, bachelor, I started working in cloud. And then after 2 years working with AWS, I thought I should, I don't know, like have like a wider, I was just curious about different technologies. Yep. Then I was like introducing to Kubernetes, joined like a different company. And with Kubernetes, you cannot just get passed by open source, right? It's like such a fundamental part how the project works. So if you're curious about Kubernetes, at some point you will notice the CNCF and you will notice like all those different projects.
I hope so. Anyway.
So then And then I was just like curious, how is it possible that like an open source community can develop like a tool as complicated and sophisticated as Kubernetes? Like how is it possible? So I was like on the technical side, interested in terms of like the ecosystem. It generates, but also like on an organizational side, how is it possible that you can have like so many contributors around the world working on this goal and working like on the side? So I joined the Kubernetes release team and I kind of contributed there for, I don't know, like 2 years or so.
Yeah.
And at some point I was also the release lead for Kubernetes.
Wow.
1.26.
Yeah.
It was
the best
awesome.
Release. I'm sure it was
the best release, definitely the best logo. So basically in SIG release, there's like a path sort of like the barrier of entry is kind of low. You need to apply. So if you get in the team, you're a little bit lucky, I would say, because we have a lot of applicants. But the sort of like obligations you need to fulfill being part of the team is at the start relatively low. And it depends like on your own engagement, how you would like to shape it out in the future. And then you can move sort of from shadow to lead, to lead shadow to release lead. And after that, there's not another role. So there's like, sort of you're asking yourself, okay, where should I go now? Because I enjoyed it so much, but should I do it all over again or should I do something else? Yeah. And I thought about this and then I saw like a need of environmental sustainability in the community that we do not really talk about this too much.
Yeah.
We don't have like a proper like hub. So if somebody is interested in energy and cloud native, like where should they go? There's not like a community group. So we just started a community group, which was quite a bit of a pain, to be honest. And starting these things take like a lot of energy, a lot of meetings. But I think if I look at this, and I also talk with some of the contributors of the tag in Paris, like if you look like the last 2 years and all those struggles which you had like in the beginning and you kind of reflect on this, where you are right now. I think it's like very worth it to put in all this effort in this space. So I think like open source is a great way to improve wherever you want to go. So because you can have contributions code wise, you can have it documentation wise, you can organize meetings, you can do like just normal code contributions, right? So there's like a lot of things you can do. So if you would like to improve as an engineer, I think open source can give you definitely like a chance to grow as a developer or as a leader or whatever you would like to do.
Yeah.
And I think this was always like super compelling to me. And it takes like a lot of energy. But there are always like times where you, like especially like at KubeCon or if you meet people and then you know, okay, it is worth it to put in this amount of energy in it.
Oh, no, I'm still tired after last week. And I didn't really do very much. Well, I interviewed lots of people, but I suppose, anyway. So you're still sort of in an early stage in your career. I guess your next steps are finishing your studies.
Yes.
What's the loose, because obviously it's a community kind of volunteer collective, but what's the loose plans for the tag in the next 6 months or so?
Right. So I think like the first year of the tag was mostly about actually getting somewhere, having like a common understanding, having some people kind of also understanding the structures of the CNCF and having like people and kind of understanding where we are going. And last year we started to have actually like some sort of output if we also do something good.
Yeah.
So we started having working groups. We had a working group, Green Reviews, which I talked about briefly.
Yep, that sounds pretty interesting.
And also another working group called Communications, which I think is like very important to us because at the end, this group only works if we work with the community. So writing blog posts, having like a website, like this landscape document, all those like things fall under working group comms. So we started those two groups. And this year we started having projects. So we are kind of expanding a little bit, having a little bit more leadership also that people can grow themselves as a contributor. That we try to offload some of the work that the chairs are doing or the other leads are doing to community people. So we have like just like a more stable and like a better community feeling. And I think this year is for the most part about keep doing what we are doing and starting new projects. So these projects, for example, we started one about Kubernetes best practices, which I think is very important. Okay. So we have two people to lead this. And we started also one about user stories, which is sort of like in the forming state. And another one about reworking the landscape document to move it like from the V.1 to a V.2, where we focus more on the end users. So if you're like a platform engineer, or if you're like a manager, or if you're like a DevOps engineer, sort of you have like the very different perspectives and different things matter to you, right? And
are you talking like, about the specific CNCF land, the big specific one?
We have like in the tag developed like a more refined version of it. The CNCF landscape focuses mostly on projects, right? And our landscape also focuses on some projects, but they also focus on organizations and a little bit like more broad, like everything that matters for us in terms of cloud native sustainability. But we are like in the process of getting it to like a next version. So getting those projects sort of started, completing those projects and trying to help contributors finding their way into the community. I think that's like our goal.
Cool. Okay. I'm pretty sure I mentioned this last time, but what's the best way for people to find information about the tag if they want to know more?
We have a website and which is called tag-env-sustainability.cncf.io.
Okay.
Which is basically, if you visit this website, you will find like all the information.
Yeah.
Like if you want to stay in touch, you should join the CNCF Slack.
Yep.
And join the tag environmental sustainability channel because this is like our main line of communication. If something is happening, meetings are happening, whatever.
Yep.
You will find out visiting this channel. And we have a calendar and like obvious things, right? So.
Awesome. Okay. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Didi.
Yeah.
Codium AI. What is Codium AI?
So we're an AI coding platform.
Makes sense. Yeah.
we help developers to code test and merge with confidence. And the emphasis is on the confidence part, right? We are really focused on code review, code analysis, generating tests, documenting code, essentially all these tasks that developers really don't like doing.
Yeah.
And it's really all about understanding that the code or making sure that code works as intended and finding any any issues that are that could arise. And we do that through two main tools that we provide. We have an IDE plugin that plugs into your VS Code or JetBrains IDEs. And then we have a Git plugin that connects directly to your Git interface, and that's across a wide variety of Git providers also. It's also kind of something that is differentiates us. Like the Git plugin is quite advanced, really helps with code reviews, helps both the reviewer and the developer that submitted the PR to review the PR, to enhance the PR, to find any issues, to automate a lot of processes around the code review as well. And then, yeah, so that's in a nutshell.
And I mean, the company is officially called Codium AI.
Yeah.
Which might give away the answer to the next question, but so you have the plugins, you have plugins for different platforms. What is happening behind the scenes to give developers this confidence?
Yeah. So, you know, when you work with LLMs or generally with AI models, like it's all about what data you feed them and how you feed the data and how you iterate on that. So we make it simple for developers to we collect the right data from their environment, the right code to feed into these models. And that includes also static analysis of the environment. So it's compiled, like parsing the code. It also includes kind of working with the LLMs in a process that we call flow engineering. Mm-hmm. So basically we call the LLM, it reflects on the request, it returns an answer. Based on the outcome, it might do another process, another iteration. It's essentially kind of, you know, it used to be called kind of chain of thought.
Yeah.
So that we do flow engineering kind of takes it to the next level where there is also intermediate steps and loops. But that's essentially what it is. It's about kind of helping the developers right where they are to bring the model, the right data, pre-process it, do a series of calls that happen behind the scene to the model, and then also some post-processing above beyond that, so that we only get the high-quality results back to the developers.
And from the model perspective, how much of it is the code that the developer and the team is working on versus general code from elsewhere? What's the balance there?
In terms of like the code that the model trained on, you mean? Or like, so the model can be used, like we can use GPT-4 also. Like, okay, so it doesn't have to be it doesn't need to be a model that is trained on your code. So it's a general purpose, like a high-end model.
Yeah.
But we feed it with the right context, with techniques of like bringing in the right data, including retrieval augmented generation, right? That is also key in this type of use case. It's not that simple to do for code. But we also have a fine-tuned version of our own model. So, and that enables like mostly the use cases of self-hosting. So when the customer wants to deploy it in their environment and does not want it to go outside, then we can also support that.
Also, I guess a degree of for a degree for those customers who want more control over where their information is going, or don't want the risk of their code being corrupted, is maybe too strong a word, but from external sources, that kind of thing. Are there sort of controls for the level of external in and out that a customer might want?
Yeah, the biggest concern I would say that folks are worried that their code will leak outside the organization, either like will find its way into a training set or a model and then somehow can get repeated by the model and other use cases. I actually think it's especially in our case where it's like the majority of the focus of our tools are around code review, enhancing code, improving code, testing code. So there's a much lesser risk for that, because we're taking the code and we're improving, we're enhancing it. For our use cases, it's generally less of an issue. But we also offer code generation, right?
Okay.
So it is more of a concern for organizations there. Having said that, like the models that we leverage, like, so for example, when we leverage OpenAI, we have a zero data retention agreement with them.
Okay.
So they don't save the data at all. We send them, we only get inference from OpenAI.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So it's like an inference provider for us. So we send code, we get inference, the code gets deleted right away. So it would not, like, it's an official agreement that we have with them, right? It would not find its way into the training data set.
Okay.
But we understand there are still organizations that would not, like, it's not still good enough for them, right?
Yeah.
And it's not, like, we talk to, like, we have a Fortune 10 now that we're working with that, no, it has to be in their environment. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. From the user perspective, you talked about code generation there. Say I've got it loaded in my my VS Code. I have tried Copilot, and of course, there's a bunch of other alternatives as well. But if I'm using Codeium, what's the experience? I want to generate tests, I want to generate documentation, et cetera, et cetera. What's the experience? Yeah. What do I do?
I think one thing we are really trying to do is to create a dedicated user experience per task.
Yeah.
Okay. So in order to really provide the best user experience for that task, even if it means that we provide less tasks, we provide the best user experience for them. So a good example for that is how you generate tests with Codeium. Like, you basically, you have this ability to choose a certain method or class, focus on that, and then generate one click, you will start getting tests, and then you'll be able to see all your different code behaviors that are built as a hierarchy. So you can see, like, all the happy path and edge cases, and then drill down into a happy path.
And this is how it works well with, like, the Git and CI plugins, I guess, in that you can generate them and then run them immediately to see if they're actually useful or not. Is that the kind of the flow there? Or
That's independent of the CI. So you generate the test, and you can actually run them right directly in the IDE.
For sure. I mean, inside
the Codeium interface, right?
Ah, okay.
So that's another unique thing about it, right?
So you have runners built in.
Yeah. So we use the environment runners, but. So
you write those as well? Because they could be fiddly in VS Code.
No. It does have its issues.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so then you can run the test right away. If they fail, we have a reflection process that can auto fix them.
Yeah.
And you have the kind of, it's kind of like we're trying to really build the best, like, user experience for generating tests.
Yeah.
And then also for the more of, like, code review related commands, it's also a very specific user experience for that. So you write, like, a slash improve command, and you can focus on a specific code component, maybe a function or a method or a class, and then you'll get a list of very focused suggestions that are categorized by different different categories, like security, best practices, performance, and then you can pick and choose what you want to apply. You can also review your entire diff, which is also kind of really nice. So as you're preparing to do a pull request, before you do that, you can have a review of all your changes and kind of make sure that this is everything you intended to do. And if there's any issues that you may have missed, maybe you forgot some hard-coded API key somewhere or something like that, you can right away get that fixed before you do the pull request.
Yeah. Okay. And from all the other tasks as well, I guess they all focus on the sort of function level functionality. That if I wanted to generate documentation, it's mostly like the method signature type stuff. It's not, and it's kind of more like reference documentation than end user documentation. Yeah.
We do provide, like, in, for example, in a Git plugin, you can we update a change log automatically. Yeah. So we can.
This is something I noticed with some of these tools. It's kind of, they give you that reference documentation, so there's still a space for humans, because just. My analogy is always, you know, it can tell you, this is a hammer, these are bits of metal, this is some dead tree. It doesn't tell you how to build something from wood, you know.
Yeah.
There's still to understand how these functional parts fit together.
Yeah, we are thinking to potentially, like, do more, like, take it to the next level where, like, say there's a new pull request, and based on the contents to update the documentation, like the README.
Yeah.
Especially as we combine more and more like repo level context and we iterate and improve our RAG capabilities and all that.
There was another company that did something like that a few years ago, that kind of vanished, where it would reference, it wasn't an AI one, but it referenced connections between code and docs and would at least then notify you this change, so you should change this.
You're referring to Swim probably.
No, it was, unless it was the people who became Swim. It was something that died.
Okay.
And Swim's doing relatively well, so it wasn't Swim. They're also Israeli, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and maybe it's the same people. I'm not sure. Yeah. I'd have to go back and look. But yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And with something like Codeium, obviously your biggest competitor is probably that Microsoft, JetBrains, some of the other vendors, where they're the main two, also have their own tools.
Right.
Varying levels. I would say the Microsoft one's far better than JetBrains, although JetBrains is about to catch up.
Yeah.
How do you compete with that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Apple problem. The inbuilt tool that just comes with it is always the hardest thing to compete with.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Like, I think one point of view to, or one way to look at it is that we have a unique point of view to this. So we believe that the hardest problem to solve in software engineering is to be able to review code, test code, and essentially make sure that code works as intended.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really, really focused on that. And we believe that kind of solving that problem unlocks a lot of the capability in generative AI for software engineering. Mm. So as we are becoming the best at that, we are in a position to really enable organizations, especially those that are very, like the enterprises, that quality is really, really important to them. So we find that it resonates with them, and we also believe that it puts us in a really good position to enable the best, the highest quality code generation. We will provide our own code generation. We are providing code generation, we'll continue to provide, but we're also going to support and work really nicely, play nicely with other code generation tools. Well, we serve as the testing and review piece because we're the best at that, okay? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of customers that use both Copilot and us, okay, in tandem. So we play nicely with them. We do have customers that just use us without Copilot. So that's kind of one way to look at it. It's almost like you can do an analogy of like maybe an Apple Watch and a Garmin.
Yeah.
So maybe like both show the, and you know, a lot of the basic code generation, code completion gets more and more commoditized. So you can say that like maybe, you can think about it like that like both show you both the Garmin and the Apple show you the time, maybe both measure your pulse. But if you're going on a run or you're really focused on outdoorsy stuff, then maybe you'll use the Garmin for that. So it is a matter of preference.
Yeah.
There's different flavors and different focus areas for different tools. So that's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
And then I might add one more piece to it, is that one thing that we are really focused on is being agnostic to the user, to the customer's environment. So for example, our Git plugin supports GitHub, supports GitLab, supports Bitbucket, supports Azure DevOps, supports a bunch of different Git providers. Yeah. And we do see, so first of all, there are the customers, many customers that, you know, they use different IDEs and then they use GitLab.
Yeah.
And to be able to have one unified experience, and that's also like, regarding competition from JetBrains, it's another thing. Like, so I barely see like big enterprises that say, oh, we only use JetBrains. No, they have developers that use VS Code. They have developers that use JetBrains. And having one unified experience across them, and also being able to define the best practices of the organization and have them being enforced across different IDs, across different Git providers. Yeah. So being agnostic to the environment.
But do you plan to support things like, I don't know, Sublime? I mean, there are other Vim, Emacs,
like Vim, NeoVim, Vim and NeoVim.
Yeah.
So we are adding more. Like, so right now we support Visual Studio Code and JetBrains.
It makes sense. It's just
that's 80%. Yeah. That covers 80%. And now we're adding, like, we're going to add Visual Studio, we're going to add Vim. And,
forget about Visual Studio.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, we are seeing some companies that have some Eclipse usage also. Yeah. So, we will add more of these ideas, but I think the concept of being agnostic to the environment and then also bringing in data from other sources where it's not necessarily coming from the Microsoft ecosystem, okay? So think about, it's really important to bring data from Jira in many organizations and give that as a context to the model. Yeah. And it's important to, at some point, we will also bring in data from the production side of the environment, okay? So data from your logs, from actually running the application can really help the model reflect and find issues. And the production workloads are not owned by Microsoft. There is a certain segment that runs on Azure, but there is a lot on AWS. There's a lot on, you know, on GCP. It's diverse, the environment. So the more we're agnostic to the environment, I think the more it puts us in a position. You can do the analogy to a Datadog.
Yep.
So how did Datadog were able to kind of flourish in a, like a multi-cloud world?
Yeah,
like,
true,
so that's how we also see it.
Just out of interest, I wonder with tools like this, you know, you mentioned that, as far as I can tell, you said that you leverage a lot of GPT-4 and build on top of it. And I would imagine that Microsoft is doing something similar. JetBrains, I have no idea. But, you know, I feel like there is this underlying problem with a lot of these AI tools that they often all pull from the same source. And it's not necessarily any different, I guess, from everyone pulling from Google Search in the past. But if everyone is pulling from the same data source, how do you ensure that you add enough differentiation to the answers, but they're still correct? This is something I did some analysis between Copilot and JetBrains' tools to see, and they were different responses. But, you know, with coding, there's always gray area. There's right, there's wrong, and then there's flavors in between.
Right.
So how do you ensure that you're different while still being correct?
Yeah, I think it's a lot about, so we want to use the latest and greatest models.
Yeah.
Tomorrow there will be GPT 4.5 or 5 or whatever. You know, and Anthropic come up with another great model and some other models will come out. And we will also be working, you know, also as we're expanding our team, we will be more and more working on models that, that we have also for self-deployment environments and also to just have our models.
Yeah.
I think it's important and strategic. But I think it's a lot about incorporating the organization's best practices into these responses. That's where that's the crucial part, okay?
Yeah.
So we're working with a Fortune 50 right now, and basically like the key part that they want to nail is how we make sure that the suggestions that when a developer asks a free text question in the chat, how do they make sure that the answer will actually take into account the best practices from their like kind of their predefined best practices and maybe other repos that define how to use different components inside their environment.
Yeah,
I think that's the companies that will solve this use case the best, like, will really flourish, I believe, and we're really focused on that.
Okay. I think we're about to have a coffee break. So let's ask one more question before it gets even louder. KubeCon EU in a year. What's on the roadmap for the next 6 to 12 months?
In terms of the you're talking about conference roadmap or like,
For you. What will you be working on and look forward to hopefully announcing in the next few months?
Yeah. So some things like I can't really mention right now because like we also going to do, basically we're going to introduce more and more automation.
Okay.
In the kind of, I would say, agentic type approach to things, but with the focus on the enterprise, with the focus on having, on still keeping the developers in the front row seat or like in the control, like in the, I guess in the, as the pilots, like still kind of a system mode, but taking it to another level of automation and agentic type approaches.
Yeah.
And that's a lot in the IDE, like inside of the IDE. Also incorporating additional data from relevant, I mentioned it a little bit, but we think it's really crucial. So bringing in more data sources from the customer environment, that's across our tools. And that will be data from other sources that are that can be documentation or production or things like that. And then also taking the automation that we do or like the tools that we do into other areas of the stack. So what I mean by that, for example, so, you know, right now we have the IDE plugin that this is for the day-to-day for the developer. We have the Git plugin for when a pull request is already in flight. But then what about the CI? What about like doing more and more automation on the CI side? So we are thinking a lot about that. And then also kind of the organization level awareness to really take it to the next level.
Cool.
So,
Good. All right. Awesome.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.